A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
The ancient Egyptians paid their pyramid builders in beer and bread, not as a perk, as the baseline currency of survival. You got your daily loaves, your daily jugs, and if the pharaoh skimped, the workforce stopped building. Today, we have countries with $50,000 GDP per capita, where families can't afford a loaf of bread without stretching the budget, and countries with half that income where staples are practically sacred in their affordability. So Daniel sent us this one, and it cuts right to the heart of something I think we all feel but rarely name. Why do some wealthy countries fail at the basics while poorer ones get them right? Is it price controls, or is there something deeper? Some unwritten cultural contract that keeps bread and wine within reach?
The timing on this is sharp. We're in May 2026. Global food prices are projected to rise another 4% this year, and Israel's cost of living crisis is front page news again. The question isn't academic. What does a society owe its citizens in terms of affordable basics, and what actually works to deliver that?
Let's start by defining what we actually mean by staples, and why the price of bread tells us more about a society than the price of iPhones.
Staples are the non-discretionary portion of household spending. These are things you can't opt out of. Bread, rice, cooking oil, eggs, milk, basic vegetables, and in certain cultures, wine or beer. They're not luxury goods. They're not aspirational purchases. They're the caloric and nutritional floor beneath which you can't function. And here's why staple prices matter more than overall cost of living numbers. If rent goes up, you can move to a smaller place. If transport gets expensive, you can bike. But if bread doubles in price, you can't eat half a loaf a day. There's a hard biological floor.
That's the thing. The prompt mentions traveling in Portugal and Spain and noticing that even though these aren't affluent countries by Western European standards, the staples are cheap. A loaf of bread, a bottle of wine, these things feel accessible in a way they don't in Israel, despite Israel having roughly double Portugal's GDP per capita. And that paradox is the puzzle. How does a poorer country make the basics cheaper?
Let me put some numbers on this because the data is striking. According to Numbeo data from this month, a loaf of fresh white bread in Lisbon costs about 80 euro cents. In Tel Aviv, you're looking at 2 euros 50. That's more than triple. A bottle of table wine in Portugal, you can find decent stuff for 2 euros 50. In Israel, you're paying 8 euros minimum for something drinkable. And Portugal's GDP per capita is around $25,000 versus Israel's $55,000, according to World Bank data from 2025.
The richer country has the more expensive staples. That's not supposed to happen in standard economic models.
It's not. And it's not just an Israel problem. The United States has expensive staples relative to many European countries with lower GDP. Australia and Canada show similar patterns. Meanwhile, Spain, Italy, Greece, they all have cheaper staples than you'd predict from their income levels. Something structural is going on.
To understand why Portugal can sell bread for less than a euro, while Israel charges three times that, we need to look at two things. Who controls the shelves, and who controls the prices?
Let's start with the shelves, because this is where the mechanism gets concrete. Israel's retail grocery market is one of the most concentrated in the developed world. Three chains, Shufersal, Rami Levi, and Asher Ad, control 72% of market share. That's according to the Israel Competition Authority's 2025 report. When three players control nearly three-quarters of where people buy food, you don't have a competitive market. You have an oligopoly with comfortable margins.
Comfortable is doing a lot of work there. When you have that level of concentration, there's no pressure to compete on price for staples. If Shufersal raises bread prices, Rami Levi doesn't undercut them because they know Shufersal will just match. They'd rather both enjoy higher margins than race to the bottom.
Compare that to Spain. Spain's grocery market is fragmented. Mercadona is the largest at about 25%, but you've got Carrefour, Lidl, Aldi, Dia, Eroski, and regional chains all competing aggressively. In Portugal, you've got Continente, Pingo Doce, Lidl, Aldi, and a bunch of smaller players. When the market is fragmented, someone will always try to undercut on staples because staples drive foot traffic. You lure people in with cheap bread and milk, and they buy everything else while they're there.
The OECD has a metric for this, the food price gap. It measures how much consumers pay relative to what farmers receive for the raw inputs. In countries with high retail concentration like Israel, Australia, and Canada, staple prices are 30 to 50% higher relative to input costs than in countries with fragmented retail like Spain, Italy, and Greece. That's not vibes. That's a measurable markup driven by market structure.
Here's the kicker with Israel specifically. In 2023, the government threatened to remove price controls on milk. The response was immediate and revealing. Retailers dropped prices by 15% overnight. Let that sink in. The threat of removing controls caused prices to fall. That means the existing controls weren't suppressing prices. They were functioning as a coordination mechanism. The retailers were all pricing at the controlled ceiling because they knew their competitors would too.
That's the musical equivalent of beige wallpaper. The price control becomes the agreed-upon floor disguised as a ceiling. Everyone nods, everyone charges the maximum, and the consumer gets the privilege of paying the coordinated rate.
Which brings us to price controls themselves, because this is where the debate usually gets heated. The prompt asks how prevalent price controls are in today's world, and the answer is more than most people think, but less than they used to be. Portugal introduced a bread price cap in 2022 during the inflation spike. The government set a maximum price of 85 euro cents per 500-gram loaf, enforceable with fines up to 50,000 euros. It did, partly because Portugal also has that fragmented retail market. The price cap set a ceiling, and competition pushed prices below it in many places. The cap was a backstop, not the actual price. In Israel, by contrast, price controls exist on a narrow set of goods, bread, milk, eggs, but they function as the price rather than a ceiling, because there's no competitive pressure to go lower.
Price controls aren't inherently good or bad. They're a tool that interacts with market structure. Give them to a concentrated market, and they become a coordination device for oligopolists. Give them to a competitive market, and they're an insurance policy.
And this is the misconception I want to bust right now. The standard Econ 101 line is that price controls always cause shortages, and Venezuela is the cautionary tale everyone reaches for. Venezuela imposed sweeping price controls in 2003, and by 2010, domestic food production had collapsed by 80% according to FAO data. Shelves were empty, black markets flourished, and people were starving in a country with some of the largest oil reserves on earth.
Venezuela's controls weren't paired with production support. The government capped prices, and then didn't help farmers produce. Input costs kept rising. Farmers couldn't make money at the controlled price, so they stopped farming. The controls strangled supply. That's not what Portugal did.
Portugal's bread cap was paired with agricultural subsidies and support for domestic wheat production. Japan doesn't have formal rice price controls, but the Zenchu, the agricultural cooperative system, manages production quotas to stabilize supply and pricing. Rice prices in Japan have fluctuated less than 10% annually for 30 years, according to MAF data from 1995 to 2025. Compare that to the US wheat market, which sees 25% plus annual volatility.
Japan has achieved what looks like a price-controlled outcome without actually setting prices. That's the unwritten contract in institutional form.
South Korea does something similar with kimchi cabbage. The government maintains buffer stocks. When prices spike, they release cabbage into the market to cool things down. When prices crash, they buy to support farmers. It's stabilization, not control. And it works because there's a cultural expectation that kimchi cabbage will be affordable. The government is just building the infrastructure to honor that expectation.
This is where the ancient Egypt comparison gets interesting. The pharaoh's granaries were buffer stocks. When harvests failed, grain was released to prevent famine and revolt. The bread and beer wage system wasn't charity. It was a recognition that if you don't feed the people who build your monuments, the monuments stop getting built. The modern equivalents are things like India's public distribution system, which provides subsidized grain to 800 million people.
India's PDS is the largest food security program in human history. And it's a fascinating case because it illustrates both the promise and the failure mode of state-managed staples. The promise is that 800 million people have a legal right to subsidized grain. The failure mode is that a 2024 report from India's Comptroller and Auditor General found that 40% of subsidized grain is diverted before reaching intended recipients. That's grain that disappears into the black market or gets sold by corrupt intermediaries.
40% leakage on a program serving 800 million people. That's not a rounding error, that's a systemic failure of distribution infrastructure. And it's not like India doesn't know this. The PDS has been leaky for decades. The question is whether you fix the pipes or abandon the system.
Brazil took the other approach. Instead of subsidizing grain directly, they created Bolsa Família, which gives conditional cash transfers to low-income families. The families buy food on the open market, which preserves market signals and avoids the leakage problem. Brazil's leakage rates are dramatically lower, and the program has been credited with significant reductions in child malnutrition.
The choice isn't between price controls and nothing. It's a spectrum. On one end, you have Venezuela, controls without production support, leading to collapse. In the middle, you have India, massive state distribution with serious leakage problems. Further along, you have Japan and South Korea, institutional stabilization without formal price setting. And on the other end, you have Brazil, cash transfers that let markets work while protecting purchasing power.
Portugal and Spain sit somewhere in between, with light-touch price caps, fragmented retail, and strong cultural expectations that staples should be affordable. The cultural expectation part is real, and I want to take that seriously because the prompt raises it explicitly. Is there an unwritten contract?
I think there is, but it's not magic. It's not just that Portuguese people are nicer about bread pricing. It's that the cultural expectation creates political consequences for violating it, and those political consequences shape the institutional arrangements.
Let me give you an example. In Spain, if a supermarket chain tried to charge 4 euros for a basic loaf of bread, they would face immediate local backlash. Not just consumer boycotts, but municipal pressure, media coverage, social media outrage. The expectation that bread is affordable is so deeply embedded that violating it is reputationally dangerous. In Israel, the expectation is different. People complain about prices, but the complaint is diffuse and the retail oligopoly absorbs it without consequence.
The cultural contract requires enforcement mechanisms. In ancient Egypt, the enforcement was simple. Hungry workers revolt. In modern Portugal and Spain, the enforcement is social and political. In Israel, the enforcement mechanism is weak because the market is concentrated enough that consumers don't have alternatives. If all three major chains charge high prices, where are you going to go?
This connects to something I've been tracking. Israel has one of the highest rates of child food insecurity in the OECD. 18% of Israeli children experienced food insecurity in 2024, according to the OECD. In a high-income country with $55,000 GDP per capita, nearly 1 in 5 kids isn't getting enough to eat. That's not just a market failure, it's a social contract failure.
When staples are expensive, households don't just absorb the cost, they cut back on quality elsewhere. Less fresh produce, more processed food. You get public health externalities that show up years later in diabetes rates, cardiovascular disease, childhood obesity. The price of bread ripples through the entire health system.
This is where the knock-on effect gets really dark. Food insecure kids do worse in school. They have more behavioral problems, higher rates of chronic illness, lower lifetime earnings. A society that can't deliver affordable staples is a society that's quietly eating its own future.
Price controls and retail concentration only tell part of the story. There's a deeper layer here about what a society expects from its food system, what I'm calling the unwritten contract.
I want to push on this because I think the unwritten contract is real, but it's not vibes, it's institutionalized. Let me walk through how Japan built theirs. After World War II, Japan faced severe food shortages. The government enacted the Staple Food Control Act, which gave the state direct control over rice distribution. Over time, as the economy developed, they liberalized, but they didn't just deregulate and walk away. They built the Zenchu cooperative system, they maintained production quotas, they created a managed transition from state control to coordinated market stability.
They deliberately designed the institutional scaffolding for what looks like a cultural norm. The norm of affordable rice is real, but it's supported by a machinery that most Japanese people never have to think about.
And South Korea did something similar with kimchi. The government maintains buffer stocks not because anyone expects a kimchi famine, but because the price of kimchi cabbage is a politically sensitive indicator. If cabbage prices spike, it makes the news, and the government's approval rating dips. So they've built a stabilization mechanism that keeps the cultural expectation intact.
Compare that to the United States, where there's no cultural expectation that bread should be cheap. There's an expectation that bread should be available in 37 varieties at the supermarket, but not that it should be affordable as a matter of social contract. The U.S. has food stamps, SNAP, which is a cash transfer approach, but the underlying staple prices are high relative to many European countries because the retail market is concentrated and there's no political consensus that bread prices matter.
Germany is an interesting counterexample within the wealthy country set. Germany has Aldi and Lidl, the discount supermarket model which has driven down staple prices across Europe. These aren't price controls. They're hyper-efficient private sector operations that compete so aggressively on staples that they've reshaped consumer expectations across the continent. When Aldi enters a market, bread prices drop because Aldi's entire business model is built on affordable basics.
The Aldi model is basically build me a chair nobody notices they're sitting in. The stores are Spartan, the selection is limited, but the staples are so cheap that the experience feels like the opposite of being exploited. It's not the cultural warmth of a Portuguese bakery, but it achieves the same outcome through market mechanism.
That's the taxonomy I think emerges from all this. There are four paths to affordable staples. Path one is competitive retail. Fragmented markets with aggressive discounters like Germany and increasingly Spain and Portugal. Path two is institutional stabilization. Japan and South Korea, where the state manages supply to keep prices steady without setting them directly. Path 3 is price controls with production support. Portugal's bread cap model where the government sets a ceiling and helps farmers produce. Path 4 is cash transfers. Brazil's Bolsa Família where you let markets set prices but give poor families the money to pay them.
The failure modes are when you do price controls without production support. That's Venezuela. When you have concentrated retail without competitive pressure. That's Israel. When you have massive state distribution with corruption and leakage, that's India's PDS.
The US and Australia are interesting cases because they have competitive retail in theory, but a high concentration in practice. In the US, Walmart, Kroger, and Albertsons dominate, and while they compete on everything except staples. Staples are where they make margin because everyone needs them, and nobody switches supermarkets over the price of bread.
That's the thing about inelastic demand. If bread goes up 50 cents, you don't stop buying bread. You just absorb it. And supermarkets know this. Staple pricing is the most reliable extraction mechanism in retail. You can't opt out of calories.
Let me pull this back to the ancient Egypt framing because I think it illuminates something modern policymakers keep missing. The pharaohs didn't subsidize bread because they were nice. They did it because hungry people revolt. The bread and beer wage wasn't welfare. It was stability maintenance. And the pharaohs understood something that modern governments often forget, which is that the price of staples is a political variable, not just an economic one.
Juvenal's phrase, panem et circenses, bread and circuses, gets thrown around as a cynical observation about keeping the masses distracted. But it's also a recognition of what the baseline contract is. If you can't deliver bread, no amount of circus will save you.
We have modern data that bears this out. The FAO has tracked the relationship between food price spikes and social unrest, and it's remarkably consistent. The 2008 global food price crisis triggered riots in more than 30 countries. The Arab Spring wasn't just about democracy. It was catalyzed by wheat prices. When the cost of staples crosses a threshold, the political order gets shaky.
Which brings us back to Israel. 18% child food insecurity, 72% retail concentration, stable prices that are triple Portugal's despite double the GDP. The question isn't whether this is sustainable. It's when the political consequences arrive.
I think they're already arriving in diffuse ways. The cost of living protests that have periodically erupted in Israel over the past decade, they're not about luxury goods. They're about cottage cheese and bread and rent. They're about the feeling that working full-time no longer guarantees access to basics.
The unwritten contract isn't just about prices. It's about the psychological security of knowing that if you do your part, you can feed your family. When that expectation breaks, you get something deeper than inflation complaints. You get a crisis of legitimacy.
If the unwritten contract is real but fragile, what can actually be done about it? Let's get practical.
For policymakers, the most effective approach isn't blanket price controls. It's targeted interventions. Buffer stocks for volatile staples, retail competition enforcement, and social safety nets that protect purchasing power. The evidence is pretty clear that you need at least two of these working together.
The retail competition piece is underrated. Israel's competition authority has the legal tools to break up concentration, but enforcement has been weak. If you reduce the three-chain dominance from 72% to something closer to 50%, you'd see staple prices drop without any price controls at all. Competition does the work.
The second actionable piece is for consumers. Understanding your local retail concentration and staple price trends can inform political advocacy. Voting for candidates who prioritize competition policy and anti-monopoly enforcement isn't as emotionally satisfying as voting on foreign policy or cultural issues, but it directly affects whether you can afford bread.
This is where I think the prompt's observation about the unwritten contract becomes actionable. The contract can be rebuilt through community-level institutions, food cooperatives, buying clubs, municipal food strategies. Belo Horizonte in Brazil is the classic example. The city government created a network of affordable food markets, subsidized restaurants, and direct purchasing from local farmers. It's not a national program. It's a city-level intervention that treats food access as a right.
Belo Horizonte reduced child malnutrition by something like 60% over a decade, not by controlling prices nationally, but by building local infrastructure that made staples accessible. That's the unwritten contract made explicit at the municipal level.
It's replicable. Community-supported agriculture, food-buying clubs, neighborhood cooperatives, these aren't replacements for national policy, but they're hedges against its failure. If your supermarket is charging extortionate prices for bread, a buying club that purchases flour in bulk and bakes collectively is a direct response.
The ancient Egyptians had the pharaoh's granaries. We have Costco. The principle is the same, aggregation for resilience. It's just that we've outsourced the aggregation to private entities that have no obligation to keep prices affordable.
I want to touch on one more dimension before we wrap the practical section. The prompt mentions wine alongside bread as a staple, and I think that's worth taking seriously. In Mediterranean cultures, wine isn't a luxury, it's part of the meal. It's caloric, it's social, it's culturally embedded in a way that's hard for Northern Europeans or Americans to fully appreciate.
The glockenspiel of corporate approachability would be a supermarket that treats wine as a premium product while claiming to understand Mediterranean culture. In Portugal and Spain, cheap wine isn't an aspiration, it's an expectation. And the wine industry is structured to meet that expectation. Small producers, local distribution, no pretense that every bottle needs to be an experience.
Israel has a wine industry, but it's oriented toward export and premium pricing. The domestic market doesn't have the same expectation of affordable table wine. It's a cultural difference that expresses itself economically. When a culture decides that something is a staple, it builds the institutions to keep it affordable. When it decides something is a luxury, it builds institutions to extract maximum value.
That's the whole thing in one sentence. The designation of something as a staple is a cultural decision that shapes economic structure.
Let me bring in one more data point that ties this together. The 2026 Global Food Price Index is projected to rise another 4% due to climate disruptions. Countries without staple affordability mechanisms are going to face increasing social instability. We're not talking about a hypothetical. We're talking about the next 12 to 18 months.
The countries that have built the institutional scaffolding, Japan with its rice stabilization, South Korea with its cabbage buffer stocks, Portugal with its bread caps and competitive retail, they're going to absorb the shock better than countries that are just hoping market forces sort it out.
The market forces argument is that high prices incentivize production, which eventually brings prices down. And that's true over the long run for goods with elastic supply. but staples have inelastic demand and supply that's constrained by weather, land, and growing seasons. You can't just produce more bread next week because prices spiked. The adjustment lag is measured in growing seasons, and in the meantime, people go hungry.
Which is exactly why the pharaohs built granaries. They understood that the market doesn't solve for the gap between harvest and hunger. Someone has to hold the buffer, and if it's not the state, it's going to be whoever can profit from scarcity.
Let me summarize the comparative picture because the prompt explicitly asked how staple costs compare across countries. The pattern is clear but counterintuitive. High GDP per capita doesn't predict affordable staples. The US and Israel are wealthy with expensive basics. Portugal and Spain are less wealthy with cheap basics. Japan and South Korea are wealthy with stable, affordable basics because they've institutionalized the cultural expectation. The variable that matters isn't national income, it's retail market concentration, the presence or absence of stabilization mechanisms, and whether there's a cultural consensus that staples should be protected from pure market logic.
Price controls are more prevalent than the free market narrative suggests, but less prevalent than they were in the mid-20th century. They're concentrated in developing economies and in specific sectors of developed ones. The interesting cases are the hybrid models, Japan and South Korea, where the outcome of price stability is achieved without formal price setting. That's the frontier.
I think the takeaway for someone living in a high-cost country like Israel is that the problem isn't inevitable. It's a policy choice and a market structure choice. Portugal is not a rich country, but it has decided that bread will be affordable, and it has built the institutional arrangements to make that true. Israel could do the same. It would require breaking up the retail oligopoly, enforcing competition law, and potentially introducing buffer stock mechanisms for key staples.
The cultural contract piece, the unwritten expectation, that's not something you can legislate directly, but you can create the conditions where it emerges. When bread is affordable for a generation, it becomes unthinkable that it wouldn't be. The expectation calcifies into norm. That's what happened in Portugal and Spain over decades. It's not that they're culturally superior. It's that their institutions have delivered affordable staples long enough that the culture is organized around that fact.
The pharaohs knew that hungry people revolt. Maybe it's time we remembered.
The question that stays with me is what happens as AI and automation reshape food production and distribution? Are we heading toward a return to the ancient model where staples are guaranteed because production is so efficient that abundance is the default? Or are we heading toward further concentration, where whoever controls the automated supply chain extracts maximum value from inelastic demand?
I think it could go either way, and that's what makes this moment interesting. If automated vertical farming, robotic distribution, and AI-optimized supply chains drive costs down, we could see a world where staples are cheaper than they've ever been. But if those technologies are captured by concentrated players who use them to maximize margin rather than minimize price, we'll get the opposite. Ultra-efficient extraction from captive consumers.
The technology doesn't choose. The institutional arrangements around the technology choose. And that's why understanding how Portugal and Japan and Brazil have solved this problem matters. It gives us models for what to demand from our own systems.
On that note, I think we've earned our daily dose of randomness.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1780s, the Isaac Sultanate in what is now Somaliland faced a succession crisis when Sultan Gulad Abdi's designated heir died suddenly, leading to a 3-year standoff between two branches of the family that was ultimately resolved by splitting the Sultanate's grazing lands. The word Gulad itself means victory in Somali, but the succession dispute was so bitter that locals began calling it Gulad's irony, a phrase that persisted in regional poetry for over a century.
That's the most passive-aggressive tribute naming I've ever heard.
Imagine your legacy being a 3-year grazing dispute immortalized in poetry. This has been My Weird Prompts. If you enjoyed this episode, share it with someone who buys bread. Find us at myweirdprompts.com. I'm Herman Poppleberry.
I'm Korn. The pharaohs built pyramids. We build podcasts. At least ours don't require slave labor.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our
show my weird prompts where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.